30th is International Translation Day. And on that day, there's going to be a public forum held on Zoom by the Endangered Languages Project. The forum is called Building Community Networks of Dignity and Solidarity. Indigenous Language Interpretation is a Human Right. One local organization, Pueblo Unido PDX, will also be a part of it. I spoke to some of the folks involved to learn more. To start, would you mind introducing yourselves?
I'm Anna Ballou. I'm the Executive Director of the Endangered Languages Project.
Hi there. I'm Noel Morales. I work with the Consejo de los Pueblos Originarios as their Director for Language Preservation. And now I'll pass it over to our President.
Mi nombre es Saul Rivera.
So this is Saul Rivera. He is the president of the Consejo de los Pueblos Originarios and also is part of the Titiro Mico movement. He is originally from Yunani, Guerrero, and he has been here in the States for 12 years.
Okay, thank you all so much for being here. Coming up on Monday, September 30th, you're hosting a public forum called Building Community Networks of Dignity and Solidarity, Indigenous Language Interpretation is a Human Right. What can you tell me about this forum?
Yeah, so this forum is a chance to share the work happening at the grassroots by four Indigenous-led interpretation organizations across the U.S., one of whom will be Pueblo Unido here in Portland, and one of whom will be the Consejo de los Pueblos Originarios, who can tell us a little bit more.
We're going to be speaking a little bit more about what our movement means for the indigenous people of Latin America, specifically. Those are the folks that we work with, and how translation into their indigenous language means that they get access to human rights. And that's essentially a lot of what the work that Saul has been doing over the 4 years that the Consejo has been around. We're coming up on our fifth anniversary. And I've been here for about a year, and so we're going to start talking about the work that we do and how that relates to just general rights of indigenous folks, you know?
Let's talk about that. Can you tell me, Noel and Saul, about your organization?
Claro que sí, Noel. Con mucho gusto.
Originally, he created the movement. Oh, the original movement of Titiro Mico was created in order to be able to generate money back into the pueblos that people are from. Originally, the movement Titiro Mico was made to create that economy for the original pueblos in order to be able to deal with migration and that need, that the economic needs of migration that is occurring. And so over his experience of living in New York for over 10 years, he started to see that the indigenous people who migrated over here weren't able to have a voice, and they had to essentially hide their indigenous identity and couldn't embrace it because of the economics and political needs that they were facing. So when he arrived here, he realized that because of the color of his skin, for simply being indigenous, for the way that he looked, he faced a lot of racism and hardship, that there were folks who, you know, abused of him because of his status as a migrant, especially as an indigenous migrant, and would rob him of even salary, and essentially tell him that because of his status, because of his race, nobody would believe him, and that's part of his story. And so, as a result of all this hardship that he faced, he, you know, spoke with his family, and they decided, you know, like, we want to support you, and you have been helping us so much. And so they decided to send him the textile work from his community of Yubinani to be able to essentially help him economically and help the community economically as well. And with that, by putting those textiles in the forefront and selling those and working with community, he started being able to get more attention to the movement and indigenous people, and essentially help with the revitalization and them no longer needing to be embarrassed or scared of sharing their language, and that helped with language preservation. And so he was able to help himself, his family, his community by selling those textiles and working and unifying the community that he had over here in the United States, who also migrated with him. And that all changed, unfortunately, due to the pandemic in 2020.
Cuando llega la pandemia, nosotros estábamos impulsando un pequeño.
During the pandemic, they had started to make bags, and they were getting ready to, you know, sell those things. But then the pandemic hit, and then everything closed, and there was a need for face coverings, for face masks. Especially within the indigenous community, because these were the folks who had to work throughout the pandemic, and unfortunately these were the same folks who, you know, passed away, who suffered, who got sick, who continued to get sick. So because of this need that he saw within the general indigenous community, not just his own, his community decided to give out these face masks to the larger indigenous community of New York and help them out that way.
Indígenas se infectaron con el COVID por seguir laborando en sus trabajos.
And so during the pandemic, they took notice that even though with all their work that they were trying to give out face masks, they faced a lot of hardship within the general indigenous community of the returning of their bodies to their original pueblos, of the folks that they were helping out and their other indigenous communities that they were working with. Even though they made a lot of contacts and were able to, you know, work with other indigenous people who were handing out food and they were handing out masks, there was just a closing of the general council doors, and they didn't, the general community didn't get the help that they needed. So it kind of depended on the forefront of their indigenous, like, brothers and comrades that they were working with to help out these communities. And so they were focused on trying to follow along with the returning of the bodies to indigenous communities and their families. But that was still an ongoing issue throughout the entirety of the pandemic.
Porque al llegar como migrantes aquí, por falta de conocimiento, tal vez por
with
ignorancia,
the realization that it is very hard to return the bodies of these indigenous migrants to their communities, they found out that a lot of our indigenous brothers and sisters did not have any official paperwork. They were essentially living in the shadows and had no official way to identify themselves, and there was the realization that there was not enough access for these folks, or maybe it was that they were just not, you know, knowledgeable or didn't have the access to, because they didn't understand in that language, like what resources there were in order to get their official documentation over here as a migrant in New York. Even though there was resources, they just didn't have the knowledge to or able to access them. And so that was something that their community, the indigenous community, noticed that they've been working with.
No se identificaban, y tal vez no tenemos la educación de hacer eso, como ir a buscar un documento oficial.
throughout all of the work they were doing, they realized that because these indigenous brothers and sisters did not fully understand Spanish, they were not able to access the medical needs, the paperwork, and all the other things that they would need in order to have documents, in order to have gotten proper checkups, in order to have gotten that access to medication. You know, they realistically needed all of this in their indigenous languages, because as many of them are learners, they just didn't fully understand what was going on. And so that's when they realized that what they needed to do was work towards getting translations in their mother languages, in their indigenous languages, and that that would give them access to the medical needs, to paperwork, to all those things that they would have needed to be able to have returned their bodies back into their communities and be able to get the help that they needed during the pandemic.
La gente de los pueblos originarios atenderse o a recibir una atención, pues creemos que es fundamental.
That's when they realized that they needed to be able to have access to these translations in places like the consulate, where the people were getting going for services, but they didn't have that access to that translation in their indigenous languages. It was only available in Spanish. So in addition to them being unable to access their legal and medical needs, they're also facing, you know, things such as labor exploitation because they don't have access to translation in their indigenous languages, and that's something that they happen time and time again. All of this experiences, all of these hardships that the community faced and that they've noticed is what led us, what led Saul, what led the community to creating the Consejo de los Pueblos Originarios, the teachings of their abuelos to create a council of indigenous people in order to advocate for themselves, in order to be able to fight for their rights to language access, is what resulted in them becoming an official group called the Consejo de los Pueblos Originarios on December 18th, 2020. And so in front of Carmen Del Rosa and the George Isla Lopez from the General Council of Mexico, they were able to form their community officially in order to be able to fight for their rights as indigenous people, to fight for their rights to have equal access to language interpretation for their medical, for their legal, and for their rights as indigenous people living here in New York. Thank you.
Thank you for that explanation. Turning to this public forum that's coming up, who is this for? What do you hope that they get out of being a part of this?
Yeah, well, I think one key hope is for the general public to learn more about indigenous language access and rights and the really huge need for these services at every level, both here in Portland and obviously in New York and across the U.S. There are communities whose languages are not being included in language access and who are not able to meet their medical or legal or other needs because of that absence of interpretation. So we're hoping the general public will tune in and learn about this issue and sort of show their support and solidarity with organizations like Consejo. We're also hoping indigenous communities will tune in to learn about how to access interpretation services and that these options are out there, and to connect with other organizations who can put them in contact with interpreters who can serve their needs. And of course, we hope policymakers will tune in and learn why it's so important that they throw their support behind language access, especially indigenous language access.
Saul talked about some of the background and the history about why this is important, but I'm also curious, you know, thinking about 2024, why is it important to tackle this issue now?
Porque es importante primeramente no perder nuestra identidad. Es importante no olvidarnos de dónde venimos.
I, you know, truly cannot say it as amazingly as Saul says it in Spanish, but I'll try my best in English. But for him, he believes that it's important in the year 2024 in order to preserve indigenous language and speak about these needs because of the fact that, you know, this is the needs of their community, but also they realistically, if the indigenous languages die, parts of their stories as indigenous people die with each language speaker who passes away. Every time that the language is lost, part of their identity, you know, is could be gone forever if people do not continue learning and appreciating and translating and teaching their children to be able to speak their indigenous languages, to be proud of being indigenous, to have pride in their history as indigenous people. And he thinks that it's so important for the next generations to have that ability, that access of their history.
Por ello es importante seguir desarrollando, buscar capacitación de intérpretes indígenas, porque, bueno, traduce ya del... Sí, no.
He wants to speak about a specific instance of his experience where he was called in by the consulate in Chicago to speak on behalf and translate for a woman who speaks the same variant of Mixteco legally for a situation.
De hablante del Mixteco del cual yo hablo necesitaba traducción, necesitaba interpretación para darse a entender con las autoridades.
So, I would just say this is a bit of a trigger warning regarding domestic violence. However, the situation with the Mixteca woman who also spoke the same variant of Sunsavi, which is the language that Saul speaks, was there at the consulate because of her husband getting deported due to, you know, physically abusing her, and they were trying to get her help. They were worried about her, but they just couldn't understand what was going on. They couldn't understand what she needed. And after speaking with Saul and being able to translate the situation, they understood that she was actually pregnant. And she was very worried about the well-being of her child because of the way that her husband had hurt her. And she came to the consulate asking for medical attention for the baby because she was afraid that she might lose the baby due to the injury she sustained. And this is an example of the situations that indigenous migrants face where they need medical attention for themselves or for their children, and they aren't able to get that without translation from an indigenous language speaker who is able to translate what the situations are going on and what they're asking for.
Es la importancia de los intérpretes indígenas para atender ese tipo de cosas.
And so he says that situations like this are why that it's so important to have access to indigenous language interpretation today and now, because there are indigenous people living here in the United States who need these services. And he says that that's why our community, our other members have been working so hard in order to get their language certifications in order to translate, to be able to help other migrants with situations like these, so that institutions and communities and other groups who are doing the work that we're doing as well can have access and can have support in order to help these other indigenous people who need that voice. And so he says that with much love, if anybody needs help with finding translations into indigenous languages for migrants, we are open, and that's why our community members have been working so hard in order to help others just like these indigenous sisters who needed help. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. So for this forum, if our listeners are interested in finding out more, maybe attending themselves, where can they find more information?
Yeah, we really hope anybody interested will tune in and learn more from these amazing organizations doing this work. You can visit endangeredlanguages.com/blog, and you'll find more information about the event and a link to register. It is free and online on Zoom.
Thank you all so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Anna, Saul, and Noel speaking with me about an upcoming public forum on Monday, September 30th at 10 a.m. Pacific. It's called Building Community Networks of Dignity and Solidarity. Indigenous Language Interpretation is a Human Right. More information and registration info is online at bit.ly/indigenousinterpretation. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his new article. It's called Unconscionably Bad Circumstances at Grants Pass Homeless Sites. Cities blame state law for hindering efforts on homelessness, but as conditions deteriorate, Governor Kotek stays quiet about homeless Oregonians' rights. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us about this. Before we get into your most recent piece on Grants Pass, let's start with some background here. Prior to August, what has been the story of homelessness in Grants Pass?
Listeners will remember that Grants Pass was at the center of a court case that ended up at the Supreme Court after the city was sued in 2018. Attorneys had said that, you know, Grants Pass had made it completely impossible for anyone to live in Grants Pass without being punished with fines or jail time. The city won that case, which essentially overturned the Ninth Circuit Court, the Grants Pass v. Johnson decision, and the Martin v. Boise decision, which were interrelated decisions by the Ninth Circuit. And it essentially sent it back. There's a state law standing in the way of fully punishing, doing what like California and some other states across the United States have done, which is just enforced with criminal and civil punishments, simply basically for being homeless. So there's a state law, it stands in the way, probably more to come on that in the future. But yeah, they won the case, and essentially they are allowed to, it is constitutional, the Supreme Court said, for them to punish homeless residents.
So then moving into your most recent visit to Grants Pass, what did you observe in these new shelter sites that they've been working on?
Yeah, I was curious about this, like what Grants Pass is doing in light of that decision, but also because of that state law and what kind of the implications are if that law ends up being challenged. And if that law goes away, any city in Oregon, you know, could potentially do what Grants Pass is doing. So while I was there, you know, a few weeks ago in August, the city designated a few new homeless sites, and they opened those just about 10 days before I went down to visit Grants Pass. I visited during a heat wave. It was 104 one day, and it was well over 100 for the other 3 days. And they basically argue that they don't have to provide anything except for a place to stay due to the state law. So they put people out on this concrete and gravel lot with no shade. They're not allowed to, the city provided no shade. People are not allowed to put tarps up, like on the fence over their tents, to try to shade themselves. And you know, there's just a lot of people out there who have really now nowhere to go. They can't stay in parks under trees. They're very familiar with the people in the community, and a lot of people in the community there have really been, you know, a little bit threatening toward homeless residents in Grants Pass. So people really feel stuck there. They're under 24-hour surveillance The city spent $29,000 on a surveillance tower that police can view at any time, and they are doing that. And basically any humanitarian aid is left to organizations down there, nonprofit organizations. Mint is one of the ones that has really stepped up over the last few years in parks and then now in these sites. But, you know, that's like 9 volunteers, and they're just running around trying to bring water to people in the middle of a heat wave.
Well, speaking of this heat wave, multiple homeless residents with disabilities have been in serious danger because of these conditions you've described. Can you tell our listeners what happened to them?
Yeah, the first day that I showed up, you know, I talked to a woman who's very kind, and she was sitting with a friend right next to a fence, just in this little patch of shade that the fence provided. And she told me that she had just been basically released from a hospital, got into a hotel to recover for 2 days. But once the 2 days was up, the only place she had to go was the site at J Street there. So she was just out in the heat immediately following that without much time to recover. You know, I talked to this guy, Chad Patty. He's 43 years old. He has multiple diagnoses, and he was in the emergency room just prior to the city opening these sites. And he was released from the emergency room. They discharged him. He went to the parks. He was having severe gastrointestinal issues. From the parks, police came just a day or so later, told him he had 20 minutes to leave. Sent him to the park where he passed out. He was still having these gastrointestinal issues because obviously he had not had enough time to recover. And he was severely dehydrated, passed out. He couldn't wheel his wheelchair to the outhouses, and he had to use a plastic bag in his tent as a restroom because he really didn't have a way to get around. This gravel is really thick, and so people with mobility devices really can't get around on the ground. So he was, you know, the first person I talked to was Dr. Bruce Murray. He works for Mint, and he told me that they had basically saved his life. He was really not doing well when they saw him.
So with that in mind, I guess, with that being something that is happening, where does Governor Tina Kotek land on this issue? The state law that requires city ordinances on homelessness to be objectively reasonable was something she passed when she was in charge at the state legislature.
Yeah, I thought that if anybody, you know, would really make a strong statement, it might be her. You know, she is the co-sponsor of this. She was Speaker of the House in 2021 when the House passed this bill. She sort of didn't want to get into necessarily how enforcement of that might work, and more just kind of repeated essentially what the law says, you know, saying that the law requires a city choosing to regulate survival activities must be reasonable. And she added something that is important. It must also take into account the resources available to houseless individuals and the impact of the city's regulations on people experiencing homelessness. That's something that Grants Pass kind of is not doing because the city really doesn't have resources. They don't have a shelter. So people really are left out there without these resources unless a nonprofit is providing it to them. So Kotek, you know, didn't really make any strong indications that she was, you know, directly explained kind of what I saw when I went there and asked if she thought it was objectively reasonable. She didn't reply to that. And then I asked if she had been in touch with the Oregon Department of Justice about this, and that she also didn't discuss. I did talk to somebody at the Department of Justice who said that Kotek's office had not been in touch with her about this.
Where do you see things going from here, or what questions are still unanswered in this story?
I think the main question is who is going to step in and say something about it. I think sort of objectively, you know, when you kind of list, you know, the things that are happening, just a bare plot of land, people can't go anywhere. They're evicted from the exact place they were told they have to go to every single week, destabilized every week. People with disabilities cannot get around on gravel. There's no water in a heat wave. Not to mention there's going to be, you know, it's going to be winter soon. So, like, what's going to happen at that point? When you list those off, it starts to become somewhat clear that it's objectively unreasonable. The question is, who's going to step in, if not the governor? The Attorney General's office, you know, hasn't said anything about it exactly, or in the sense that they have not said that they would step in. And so it may be just something like a lawsuit, a class action lawsuit or something could happen in the future. I don't know. It just, who knows? You know, and then on the other side of it is kind of how, thanks to the Supreme Court's decision, like, this is how cities, states, entire regions and our nation are choosing to deal with homelessness.
If our listeners are interested in learning more, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They accept cash and Venmo and tips, and you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts?
I guess the only thing is that this is really important in the context of the state. It's, you know, I know there's like Portland Station, Street Roots is a Portland newspaper. Why am I going to Grants Pass? And of course, it's the Supreme Court's decision, but cities, you know, liberal, democratic elected officials are calling for that law to be repealed, which is the only thing even remotely standing in the way of people doing this everywhere.
Well, Jeremiah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk through this with us.
I'll tell you, thanks for having me.
That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called "Unconscionably Bad Circumstances at Grants Pass Homeless Sites. Cities blame state law for hindering efforts on homelessness, but as conditions deteriorate, Governor Kotek stays quiet about homeless Oregonians' rights." More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited